Welcome, everyone, all those you are with us on Zoom and those that are here on Facebook. And so, first of all, welcome to week seven. It's week seven of a series which we've been doing based on the book Life in the Balance by Rabbi Raphael Pelkowitz and his son, Dr. David Pelkowitz. And today, as we advertise, we are incredibly fortunate to have the author himself, Dr. David Pelkowitz, talking to us, which we'll have a conversation shortly. I'll just give a very short introduction. First of all, Dr. Pelkowitz has a very long biography. So the gist of it is he holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration of Yeshiva University. He's an instructor in pastoral counseling, director of he was for a long time the director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital in NYU School of Medicine, clinical professor of psychology, consulted extensively with the Jewish community, researches extensively in family violence, the impact of domestic violence, stress management, trauma, transmitting values, and the list goes on. On a personal note, and I don't want to take up too much time because I want to hear from Dr. Pelkowitz himself, but on a personal note, it's a good time for me to show gratitude to Dr. Pelkowitz on a personal note for tremendous help that he's given me over the years, guidance, mentorship, resources. Often when we deal with topics that many of you have heard from me, sometimes the resources and the sources come from Dr. Pelkowitz, who graciously and very humbly gives of his time whenever I call him, and I'm really, very, very deeply grateful for that. So, Dr. Pelkowitz, as you know, your book has been the foundation of the series which we've been doing this particular term. We often do a series based on a book, and your book has been amazing. And we really thank you for taking the time to be with us today. So, just if we can begin, one of the things that fascinates me about you in general, but about your book in particular, is the combination of your amazing Jewish learning and the research and psychological literature that you often quote from in a more modern sense. And I wonder if you would just talk to that sort of that combination between whether it's positive psychology or any area of psychology as it's sourced in Jewish thought, and how that combines with modern day psychological thinking and how the two come together for you.
Excellent question. I've always been attracted by the consistency between the two systems of thought. Even though it's not inherently obvious, to me it's been obvious, partly because it's the way I was raised. It's basically, the whole idea of what the Musar movement is about, that whole movement of Jewish thinking that's based on the idea that life is a constant quest towards self-perfection, towards working on mar midot, working on self-improvement. And especially when I started reading heavily in the field of positive psychology, it just seemed to be a natural kind of an integration. I can't think of a single time that it isn't integrated. Actually, it's interesting because the only exception to that was a number of years ago, I was bothered by the finding that, our rabbis tell us that if you have to choose between being the strongest of the weak or the weakest of the strong, meaning being a Rosh Hashuala, being the head of the wolf, or the tail of the mighty lion, much better to be the head of the tail of the mighty lion. So it's better to be among the weaker of the strong. As meaning if you have a choice between going to the top university in the Southern Hemisphere or in the world, and being one of the weaker students, or going to a weaker university where you're going to be kind of do much, much better. So our rabbis tell us, you're better off striving by being the bottom of the barrel in a place that will demand more of you. And that's not what psychological research shows. There have been, I think, over 80 studies done all over the world. And every single study done all over the world says the same thing. It basically says that that's not the case. It says, you know what? People do better when they're the top of the heap in a weaker university, or even at every level of education. You're better being the top of the weak than the weak of the weaker of the strong. And it always bothered me. And I shared this with Rabbi Hauer. Rabbi Hauer is now the new head of the OU, the new head of, you know, largest modern Orthodox Jewish organization in the United States and North America. And he knew it bothered me. And one day he calls me up all excited because he came across an explanation from one of the most respected rabbis of the last generation, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who says, you know what? He says, you know, when our rabbis tell us that it's better to be the weak, the bottom of the barrel, okay, as opposed to the top of the barrel in a weaker place. I say that's only in talking about education for adults. Adults should always be striving, but the reality, Rabbi Auerbach says, that's not true of kids. It's not true of even people at the university level. You know, he said that, and that made sense. It was the only clear contradiction I ever saw. So I love that integration, and I love that it all came alive for me when positive psychology was developed as a psychological science in its own right. That was a very long-winded answer. I apologize.
No, that's a beautiful answer. But just on that, if I can just ask you, so the integration between positive psychology and Jewish thought, is that stronger than, for example, original psychology, classical psychology?
I think very much so. Very much so. You know, classical psychology or Freudian psychology, there are ways of integrating it, but it's not as natural. Actually, Freud himself grew up as a member of a very prominent rabbinic family. He married the granddaughter of one of the most famous European rabbis in the world, a woman named Martha Bernays. But he grew up with a very strong traditional Orthodox Jewish background. And then he developed kind of an antipathy towards organized religion. And that showed itself, even though he developed in different ways as he got older. But the reality is that positive psychology, it's like literally exactly what the Musar movement has been talking about for the last number of centuries. So it's like an incredible thing to me.
Wow. Yeah. So just before we get into some concepts, and by the way, before I continue, can I just ask everyone, we will have some time for questions. So if you can post questions on the chat, and then we'll try and get Dr. Welkers to address them if people have questions. Just before we get into some concepts, you wrote this book together with your father. Just can you give us a bit of background on the history of the book and
that? Sure. And this, I think, of all the things I'll probably say this morning, is what time is it there in Sydney now?
It's 25 past 9:25 a.m.
9:25 a.m. Okay. I'll tell you the way it happened. My father, who died about a year and a half ago after a long, incredible life, and maybe I'll have a chance to tell you a little bit about, he had an unbelievable death in terms of saying goodbye to all of us, with all of us gathered around his bed, holding his hand, singing his favorite songs to him. And then his last words told us how to live our lives. It was like literally, it was the most unbelievable kind. He died with a smile on his face.
Wow.
Literally, he died, in the arms of my mother with a smile on his face. It's a very, very happy 96-year-old man. But he was a prominent rabbi in New York, in a suburb of New York. But he was older and he had already retired. He used to say the toughest thing about retirement is that he misses the vacations. Okay, it's a challenge at retirement. But one of the things that started to hit me is he had this incredible knowledge going back to the early to 19, the late 1920s in Palestine, where he went and he was there during the Hebra massacres, during that very difficult period of time in what was then called Palestine. And he had all of this incredible deep knowledge because he was very close to a number of very well-known people, and he had a pretty amazing life in terms of the different kinds of experiences that he had throughout his life. And it looked to me like a lot of that stuff was going to die with him. He had written a lot, and he had written many articles, and he wrote a number of very respected works. But nothing about this part, the part of him that I think, without formal training, had a natural feel for psychology. He connected very deeply with thousands and thousands of people who felt close to him. So I started bugging him. I said, I don't want this to die with you. Let me come to the house once or twice a week, and I'll come with my laptop, and I'll name a topic for you in psychology, and I just want you to talk. Stream of consciousness. And he said, no, I'm not going to do it. It doesn't make sense. Come on, I'm an old man. What do I have to really offer? And it wasn't a false modesty. It's just he didn't see the point of it. And I seduced him. We started doing it twice a week for a number, for a few years. It became the high point of his week. And it changed me because I learned so much stuff. You see it in the book, but it was stuff that would have died with them otherwise. And I think that everybody on this meeting, you have such a person in your life. It might be an elderly parent or grandparent. It might be somebody in the community. You just sit with people, talk to them about whatever their passion is, and amazing things could come from it. He was totally pessimistic that it would ever be finished. And then we finished it. And not only was he extremely proud of it, but wherever he would go around the world to give talks, or he spoke a lot, he was a very very gifted speaker and very much in demand. He was an unbelievable salesman for the book. He would just sort of say, oh, by the way, my son and I wrote a book together. This was totally not like him. He really felt that this was his legacy. So that was another part of it. And if I could say one more thing about him.
Yes, of course.
Questions. One thing that I learned a tremendous amount from. When he was 96 years old, everybody knew that he probably didn't have long left, even though his brain was as strong as ever. He gave a speech. They had a dinner for him in his honor. And many hundreds of people came. It was a beautiful dinner with people talking about him and honoring him and things like that. And he gave this speech. He was already unable. He didn't have good enough balance to stand up, but his mind was incredibly sharp. And here's what he said. He said, as I'm at the end of my life, this is what I want to work on. He says, I want to work on continuing to learn how to fail better. I want to learn how to fail better. He says, that's what I have to work on. He says, of all the things I need to really excel is to learn how to learn from my mistakes. The word Elul, the month that we're in now, going to Rosh Hashanah, is in Aramaic, it's the word for search. The whole idea that says Yalula, that's the Aramaic word for search, and backwards it's Lule, which means the Yevomlis. how do I handle the if onlys of my life? And when he died, his Shiva was an unbelievable experience for me, because literally thousands and thousands of people came from all over, including a bunch of little kids in the neighborhood who he used to give undivided attention to. They would come and ask him for advice. He had the ability to really focus and listen very, very deeply. And when he died, first of all, I heard many stories about how he taught them how to embrace failure as an engine of growth in a very positive way. Unbelievable stories. But the most amazing thing about him is that he would often say, in a quote from The Death of a Salesman, attention must be paid. So Louis Lohman says, attention must be paid. He says, we're living in an era where people don't focus and they don't listen and they don't pay attention. And what he said was, you have to, just focusing on people, hearing them, being there for them. So all these little kids in the neighborhood, these were little 7, 8, 9, or 10-year-old kids, when he died, they came, they flocked to the Shiva. They never, you know, came over to me or my siblings to pay a condolence call. They were too shy for that. But there was like a ritual that every morning, the time that he used to meet with them, when they'd come over or evening, they would come and they would look at the chair that he used to sit in most of the day towards the last couple of years of his life. And you'd see tears streaming down their face, because he was unique to them because of his ability to listen and to live the life of attention must be paid. Anyway.
Wow, wow. That is amazing. Thank you so much. That is very beautiful. So can we come back for a moment to positive psychology?
Yes.
Because that, I mean, I know that's a very big basis of the book, and I've heard you talk about positive psychology many times, and we've spoken about it. Maybe just talk a little bit about sort of the foundation of positive psychology and its relationship to Jewish thought in a more specific way, if you can.
Yeah, sure. So in terms of the foundations, it's based on the whole idea that too much of psychology is based on avoiding the negative. You know, as Dr. Seligman, the founder of positive psychology, would say, you know, when we dream about our children and how, or our grandchildren, how we want them to turn out, nobody dreams that I just want to raise a child who falls short of a DSM diagnosis of depression or anxiety. Nobody dreams about that. What do we want? Again, studies done around the world, the number one dream of every parent and grandparent for their child or grandchild or for people they love is they grow up to be a decent human being. And they grow up to be happy. They grow up to be fulfilled. So just avoiding depression or anxiety, which is really what traditional psychology is about, doesn't do anything for us. But to learn how to flourish, to learn how to embrace the world with passion and with kindness and forgiveness, that's an amazing, amazing kind of gift to be able to learn how to do it. And that's totally consistent with Jewish thinking, which is a constant effort at self-improvement. What other religion has a 40-day period, which we're in now, just to focus in as mindful a way as possible on self-improvement? You know, that's amazing to have a religion that teaches us how to do it, and how to be honest with ourselves, and how to have integrity, and how to handle anger and forgiveness. So that's the key to me. And it's very Jewish, and it's also very psychological. So it's a perfect integration.
Wow. So if we talk about,
can I tell you a story? Do we have time for a story, or maybe?
Well, sure, please. No. Sure. I thought you were here. Please.
Yeah, I remember we have this in the book. It's what happened in Frankfurt, Germany, a few years back. Here's what happened. There was a conference every few years in Frankfurt, Germany, that was paid for by the companies in Europe who benefited from slave labor during the Holocaust. So by German law, they had to pay for a conference for survivors of the Holocaust, Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, and the mostly Russian therapists who took care of them. And somebody came over to me, they heard me give a speech somewhere in Switzerland, and it was somebody comes to me, and he had been running this conference. And he heard the way I do this integration kind of thing. He said, I have a wild idea. He said, all these years we had this conference, but we never had the Jewish angle on it. And he says, do you think that Judaism has anything to offer to our understanding of suffering? Which to me was like a very eye-opening question, because to me, that's what Judaism really does well. We do theodicy well. We do well that meaning-making things. So he said, well, let's try it as an experiment. And since then, I've been invited to this conference every couple of years when they had it. And the first time I went, I gave a talk integrating the thoughts of really Rabbi Hirsch, Rabbi Shamshur Folk Hirsch, one of the great rabbis of the 19th century in Frankfurt. Nobody there had ever heard of him. Hitler had robbed them of their Jewish education. And I spoke about his brilliant insights into how to deal with suffering. And they were amazing insights. So I wasn't thinking much of it. I had headphones on, and everything I said was being translated into, I think, five languages, into French, Russian, German, and I think Swiss French, and Hebrew. And it was interesting because a certain segment of the audience would laugh like a minute after I cracked the joke. Everybody else would laugh, but one subculture laughed about a minute later. So I won't guess which subculture that was. I don't want to get into trouble. But the bottom line was, after I gave that first talk, a line of 40 people lined up to ask me questions. And every one of them said the same thing. They said, David, do you know how lucky you are to have grown up with the gift of learning how to integrate Jewish thinking secular thinking? They said, we were wrong. That gift was stolen from us. The Russians in the audience had it stolen from them by communism. The Europeans in the audience it was stolen by Hitler. And the first woman on the line who spoke was a woman who had repressed what had happened to her 70 years earlier, when Mengele, in a sadistic kind of action, he chose her seven siblings to go up to the gas chambers while she watched, and sadistically allowed her to live. From that day on, she no longer thought in Yiddish. From that day on, she developed traumatic amnesia to that horror and totally renounced any kind of Jewish identity. And there was something about that talk, integrating, kind of integration we're talking about, that everybody said, do you know how lucky you are to have had this? And what was fascinating to me was that I hadn't seen it until then. Hard to have gratitude for something you don't even recognize. And that opened my eye to that. So that's part of the power of this.
Wow. So more specifically, I mean, if we talk about focusing on flourishing, not just staying away from negative and depression and so on, some of that, a lot has to do, I'm, you know, with making right choices, sometimes having mastering the art of self-control, self-growth and so on and so forth, which can be, I know we have the ability to do that, and that's part of what positive psychology teaches us and the fundamental idea in Judaism of free choice and so on. But how does one develop that ability? What would you say it's probably a long discussion, but what would you say is the sort of the fundamentals of developing that identity to have the right perspective, to make the right choices, to focus on the positive, and so on?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing is the brilliant work, you know, of Viktor Frankl. So Viktor Frankl wrote A Man's Search for Meaning, some people between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our choice, in that space lies our growth. Interestingly, the Musar experts talked about the Kudat Tavachira, point of choice, saying that all of our internal growth, and in many ways, you know, our ability to develop self-control, our ability to live a life marked by internalization of values, it comes from that. How do we occupy that pause between stimulus and response, the ability to pull back? You know, it's interesting. The Hebrew word busha, which is the word for shame. So there are two kinds of shame. I think there's a chapter in the book that talks about this, I think.
We did it last week.
Oh, you did? Oh, great. So you see about it, that whole idea, it's the step back response. And I find it fascinating in every single religion. In every single culture, shame is shown the same way. It's the step back and looking down. And that break in the flow is in some ways, I think, at the heart of what we're talking about here. And, you know, it's the way we want to raise our families. It's the way we want to live our lives, is to be able to have a thoughtful life where we can take that step back and ask ourselves the question, is this consonant with my values? Is this what I want? Is this the way I want to live my life? You know, we have to constantly, you know, there's that whole idea, I could talk about goals for a minute. Goals is all important. It's all important to the extent that we live our lives tied to having our eye on the ball in terms of answering the core three questions that Jacob prepares his family and army to answer for the fateful encounter with his brother and sworn enemy, Asa, right? So he says, here's the three questions you have to be ready to ask. Who are you? Where are you going? And what are you going to do with what you have? You know, the research shows that to the extent that we discipline ourselves to keep our eye on the ball in terms of our goals, two things clearly happen. Our happiness levels shoot up, and it makes it more likely that we're going to realize those goals. And the person who really, I think, hit the nail on the head is Michael Josephson, the head of the Center for Ethics in California, in the United States. Here's what he says. He says, here's how you have to live your life. He says, you have to picture yourself as the fly on the wall at your own funeral after living 120 years and you're about to be eulogized. What are the three ways that you want to be remembered by your family members who are giving your eulogy? Think of the three main points that you want to live in terms of a legacy, in terms of your, not your resume virtues, but your real value virtues. And he says, think of those three core ways you want to be remembered. And then he says, live life that. Live life backwards. Keep your eye on the ball with where you're going. That's what this 40-day period is all about in the Jewish calendar. You know, how do we want to go? How do we want to have focus on all of that? Okay, so that's that thought.
So on that theme about this 40-day period, so we are in the period of Elul, and we're coming up to, which is the season of change, I suppose, the season of reflection. We haven't done the chapter on change yet. Perhaps we'll do it next week, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit. What are the building blocks of change? But I think another part of the question would be, if you can talk to it, is the method or the strategies that are useful in terms of achieving sustainable change, internalized change. In other words, people often get very inspired. It's Rosh Hashanah coming. It's a new year. You know, they talk about in modern literature, New Year's resolutions that do work or don't work. But real change, in other words, using some of the concepts we're talking about to achieve internalized and sustainable change.
Yeah, so such an important thing to think about, especially now. Because life's about change, and it's so important to think about it in a focused kind of way. So the main recommendation that I think that helps me to think about, and certainly echoed in the research on the psychology of change, is that you could take the course, you know, that you just took, you know, this 7 lecture series going through the book. What the research shows, about a third of you may have been intellectually interested by it, but it's not going to make any sustained change in your life, because it's nice, but it doesn't mean that you're ready for that kind of change. If you're interested in that kind of change, you move on. That's about a third of the population of the research. Another third will be somewhere in the middle. But then there's a third that will take on permanent change that will really be woven into the fabric of their life. And what the research on this shows, what causes the core difference between group 1, group 2, and group 3, the group that engages and sustains change figures out a way to ritualize it, to build it into the fabric of our lives. It could be through ritual, very hard to do it without some kind of ritual, through some kind of daily practice. You know, I remember when I was trying to get into the habit of exercising, I knew from everything I've read about how to develop a habit, that it had to start with putting on one pair of running shoes on my right foot, I'm saying one shoe on my right foot, another running shoe on my left foot, and then to just walk around the block, and then to just keep building on it. Small, tiny, sustainable habits are what starts to lead to change, but built into ritual. So for example, with the practice of gratitude, you know, which is a chapter that you read, practice of gratitude, the key to sustaining gratitude is very hard to do with that ritual of a count your blessing exercises tied into a regular ritual. So that might be Friday night going around the table. It might be, you know, my kids do it and they like it. My kids do it and they like it. Also in terms of values development, in terms of change. I play a game. I don't think I put this in the book, but it's a game that all of my grandchildren love. They love, okay? They love coming here to play the game with me. They fight with each other and walk me to a shoal in the pre-pandemic times. And they'd say, let's play ethical dilemma. Let me tell you what ethical dilemma is. It's, I would talk to them about something that happened to them during the week. And I'd say, let's talk about what you would do. So it might be, I might've talked to my granddaughter. Was this in the book, this stuff about playing ethical dilemma? It's in a book called Giving Voice to Values that I'm coming out of Harvard. But let me just quickly give you an example from real life, how it plays out. So let's say I would ask my grandson, my oldest grandson, okay, you know, he's a very good athlete. And he's, you know, I hammered him into his head, the need to be kind to kids who are klutzes like me, aren't such great athletes like me. And we talk about, you know, what's it like when you have pressure on you to pick certain kids on your team, even though you know that they're going to probably destroy the chances of your winning the game. Life is filled with those kind of ethical dilemmas. And we talk about it a little bit maybe from a Jewish perspective. We talk about it from a common sense perspective. I then have them consult with their parents and with their siblings on what they would do and whatever the given ethical dilemmas that they choose. And I share with them the many ethical dilemmas I face on a daily basis. I change some of the facts so that I'm not violating confidentiality, but they love it. They love it because it's tied to their life in a very quick vignette. I have a granddaughter who is very, very good at playing ethical dilemmas. She has that kind of a mind. She's just very good at figuring this stuff out. Very bright kid, I can say, is a totally objective grandfather. And she loves playing the game. And once I was a scholar in residence in some hotel, I think on the in the Canadian Rockies. And she was getting some pressure to from her friends who was in the program that the hotel had for kids her age. They say, let's disappear our counselor. I mean, let's make believe she's not here and ignore everything that she says. Let's just disappear her. You know, that's a fun thing that 11-year-old girls love to do. It's what those middle school years are all about. You know, let's disappear the counselor. So my granddaughter runs. She makes an excuse to leave. She runs to the part of the hotel where my daughter and son-in-law are. And she says, Eva, Abba, I have an ethical dilemma. What should I do? And she talks about the ethical dilemma. And my daughter and son-in-law say, you figure it out. You tell me what you should do. And of course, she thankfully came up with the right answer. And she runs back to the girls and said, I'm really not comfortable playing this game. They had nothing to do with her for the rest of the week. But we were very proud of her. That's, and she's a popular, normal kind of kid. I won't brag about her. But that's the key. The key is how do you build these kinds of exercises into the fabric of your life? Count your blessings, etc. Those kind of things.
Wow, very helpful. Can I just go to something else that's not specifically in the book? It's a bit in the book also, I think, but I just recently read an article. I know you've directed me in the past on literature to do with mindfulness and the Jewish connection and so on. But recently, I read the fascinating two things from you, actually, that you talk about how empathy has been on the decline because of technology. And you connected it with the concept of lack of mindful living. And particularly to do with children, but I think to do with adults also, just the fact that people are distracted. Could you just talk to that a little bit? I think it's such an important concept. And maybe going into the new year, it's also something to reflect on.
Right. So for those of you who have your Zoom windows open, okay, as I talk to you and look at you eye to eye, face to face, heart to heart, what we know from research, even on Zoom, if you're giving me your undivided attention, you're not multitasking, you're not, you know, answering emails and texts and doing a million different things, but if you're giving me your undivided attention, what research in the last 15 years show, which many of you are sure familiar with, is there are mirror neurons, meaning that as you look at me, it's only through the visual contact, if we're paying attention to each other, our hearts bounce off each other. We literally become like one, even our brain waves. As I tell a story or you tell me a story, kind of are in sync with each other. And it turns out that's one of the building blocks for empathy. Empathy is built by undivided attention. One of the saddest and most replicated studies in clinical child psychology is something called the still face experiment. I don't know if you have a chance to show it maybe in one of your subsequent classes. Still face experiment is, there's a psychologist at Harvard, Dr. Tronick, and he takes a young baby, and the young baby's mother, who is a healthy mother giving her child undivided attention. And then the mother is told, okay, I now want you to present a stone face response to your little infant. As your infant tries to get your attention and starts to try to seduce you with his or her smile and calls to you, don't respond. 3 minutes of not responding. And it's heart-wrenching to see, because what you start to see is initially the child does everything he can to get the mother to respond. He calls, he coos, this is a very young little baby. And then ultimately the baby starts crying hysterically. And then at towards the end of the 3 minutes, the baby just gives up. And when I show that still face experiment to audiences when I'm giving parenting talks, it's often met with tears because it's the challenge of our time. It's the challenge of our time. Empathy is grounded in focus and paying attention and really being there without the fragmentation. There's an ancient saying that was from a Jewish book written in the Middle Ages. And it says, Hashem yatzileni mipitzur hanefesh, which basically means God save me from fragmentation of my soul. And it explains, how does your soul get fragmented? By just thinking about a million different things. What Shabbat is about, our rabbis tell us, is the antidote to fragmentation. So you have to go into Shabbat with the mindset as if all of our work from the week is finished. What a gift. What a gift. You know, I had a fascinating, and I'll make this the last thing I'll say because I know that we're going to have questions and comments. You know what, let me stop here. Let me stop here because I could go on. Maybe we should. I think that people are going to want to ask things or say things or whatever.
Is this a little, one question we have here from someone, I'll just read it. Are you aware of the principles of conversational intelligence and Judith Glass's work around the importance of moving from I thinking to we thinking?
I'm not, but it sounds amazing. It sounds amazing. Yeah, can you educate me about it? Let me hear.
I'm not sure, I think the person is muted, so. I'm not sure actually I can unmute the questioner.
Okay. But I can imagine what it's about. Yeah, that whole idea of, basic communication, being able to pull together. One of my favorite images during the times of this pandemic is the research where they take people, these researchers take people, put them at the bottom of a hill, and they say, estimate the steepness of this hill. If you're alone, you see the hill is very steep. If you have somebody at your side, the hill looks less steep. The closer you are to the person at your side, the less steep the hill looks and the less tired you get walking up the hill. That's what it's all about. It's about the connection, about the underlying root system that connects us. That's the key. You know, that's the key. To go from I to we, you know, is really, by the way, you know, anybody will tell you that we do much better in the times of the pandemic if we, not only work on ourselves and meeting our own needs, but we reach out to others as that we, and we do kindness for others. And we, you know, that random acts of kindness exercise in the chapter on Chesed, really captures that, yeah.
Just another question about listening. So what if you are listening, but get distracted by trying to jump in and help them?
Yeah, that's great. That's another excellent question. You know, the Hebrew word for listening, okay, which is, the Hebrew word for the ear, right, ozen, is etymologically tied to the Hebrew word maznayim, which is the scale. And there's something very balancing about really listening to something, really being there. But it's hard. It's hard to do that. It's hard to be focused, especially since we're living in an era where it's hard to really be present, but we could build it up. You could build it up. You just have to build it up. Mindfulness exercises, which is so all important, just even in terms of building up our immune function. Two excellent new books on Jewish mindfulness that are amazing. One written by Rabbi Dr. Feiner, a rabbi and a psychologist, Yoni Feiner in the Muncie area of metropolitan New York City, wrote a wonderful, wonderful book on Jewish mindfulness. I was privileged to write the introduction to the book, sharing some of the stuff that we just shared. And the other is written by Rabbi Dr. Benji Weiss, two rabbi / psychologists who have made a brilliantly looked at what's unique about Jewish perspectives on presence, on being there, just being there. You know something? I've done a lot of work in the area of trauma. That's been my main secular interest. And one of my colleagues, who's one of the leading people in the world on trauma, he once told me the following. He says, if you could ask only one question of somebody, only one question that will let you know how much resilience they have built into their social support system. He says, here's the question to ask. Do you have one person in your life who you could wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning if you're troubled and you want that person, you want to be able to talk to that person? So I must have primed my brain. 3 o'clock that morning, I woke up automatically. I wasn't planning on doing it. And I turned to my poor wife and I say, Lonnie, get up. Today I want to talk to you. She jumps at it. She says, sure, what do you want to talk about? I said, go back to sleep. Thankfully, she didn't remember it the next day, but that's the key.
Wow. Yeah. So Dr. Focus, I know that you have to go to a show, Brachus. So yeah. I'm going to end soon as well. I'll just ask you to leave us with one thought, just in context of what's happening now. I don't know what's happening in terms of regulation in your end of the world, but in Sydney we're fairly lucky. But still, this Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur for many people is going to be different. In terms of restrictions of going to shul, I mean, we have minyanim, but it's going to be different and much more restricted. The people that won't make it to shul and won't have as many guests that they normally have, and so on and so forth. Leave us with just one thought about digging within and making it meaningful and amazing as possible without the external, normal foundational help, the sort of things that help us along, the support.
Yeah, look, it's an amazing gift. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's a time to take a step back and to ask some of those core questions about where we're going. And it's about connection. Okay, it's true. It's a different kind of connection this year. I know in our community, because of all of the protections that are in place, so we have it in different tents throughout our community, but it's going to be a 2-hour service. It's usually more of a 4 or 5 hour service. 2 hours with very little singing, with just the core basics. And I miss it. I miss the connection. There's a lot of loss that comes with it, but I also very much welcome the stillness that comes with having a much longer day at home with my family. The key to really, I think, what this time of year is all about is the connection and the stillness and the reflection. That's the key. I'm excited about it, to be able to take and say, here's my reading. I always have certain projects. So just came out yesterday, okay? Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, his brand new book on morality, which got incredible reviews on a lot of the things we've been talking about, on values, on self-improvement, and ways that only he could do it. So I'm going to take time to really think about it. I have a whole list of books and prayers and things like that. And I'll just say one last thing. No, I can't end on a negative. But maybe I'll just say something fascinating. And that's that the Rabbi Hirsch I spoke about before, a well-known rabbi from Frankfurt, he's a brilliant, brilliant man. He evidently was so concerned with the lack of depth in the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services in Frankfurt that he announced one Yom Kippur night, one Kol Nidre night and one Yom Kippur, I am closing down all of the synagogues in Frankfurt. And we should stay home and just appreciate the stillness and reflection, because that's what Yom Kippur is really all about. And he did it. A lot of people didn't believe it, but a friend of mine actually called his granddaughter, who's still alive, who lives in Washington Heights in New York City, right near where my university is. And she said, yeah, he did it. He actually did it. He had the power and the strength. And it was evidently an amazing experience, because sometimes the only way to appreciate something is to experience the opposite. I know that my self-reflection and the quality of my prayer has gotten a lot better since this all started. I can't wait to get back. I really can't wait. I miss my friends. I miss my community. I miss everything. But boy, do I love it. And will I miss it when we're on full reentry? So it's an opportunity.
Wow. Thank you so much. Just a small thing. You know, a few years ago, before I gave my first series on mindfulness, I spoke to you. I don't know if you remember, and you directed me to an article by Rabbi Weiner. At that time, it was an article, I think, just he'd written. And I was just...
That's right, right.
And it was just great to see the book came out. And that's why I read your piece about empathy. And then you referenced the full article, which I found on the web. So it's incredible to bring it up. Dr. Velgovits, thank you so, so much. That was amazing. I think I talked for everyone that we could probably go on for hours, but you have to go and people have a day ahead. So I want to wish you, first of all, Ktivah v'chatimah tovah, just a Shana tovah, really, really good year ahead. We should only hear good news from each other. Thank you so much always for your guidance and your support and your amazing wisdom. And we wish you everything only good. And thank you very, very, very much. It's been absolutely amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, everybody. And it's a pleasure to talk to the future. I love it. So thank you. Okay.
All the best. Bye-bye. Thank you, everyone, and have a wonderful day. And we'll be back next week to end the series, just one more chapter. Hopefully everyone has a great weekend and a great week ahead. Thank you so much for joining. Come in.